The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, and I'm Director of Author Events here. And I'm very excited to welcome our writer tonight because she is one hell of an author. Natasha Dionne's debut novel, Grace, depicts the violent, terrifying world of the antebellum South, where the emancipation of slaves can bring anything but freedom. According to Jennifer Senior in the New York Times, Dionne is not just another author to watch. She has delivered something whole and to be reckoned with right now. And then, later in the review, Jen writes, "The plot of this novel, as intricate as it is not what makes this debut such a dazzler. It's Miss Dionne's real and rare ability to make reading a felt, almost physical experience of terror, rage, identification, and sorrow." Recipient of a Penn Center USA Emerging Voices Fellowship, she is an attorney, writer, law professor at Trinity Law School, and creator of the popular Los Angeles-based reading series, Dirty Laundry Lit. Please join me in welcoming Natasha Dionne.
Thank you so much, Andy, and thank you for being here today. I'm Natasha. I've never been to Philadelphia before, so this was amazing coming here and just seeing all the history and being part of it. So I'm going to open by reading the opening of the novel. I am dead. I died a nigga a long time ago, before you were born. Before your mother was born, before your grandmother. I was 17. Still am, I reckon, and everyone that was there that night is dead now too, so it don't matter that I was a nigga or a slave. What matters is that I had a daughter who had daughters and they had theirs. Family, I could have saved a whole lot of trouble by telling them the things that I know. But there are some stories that mothers never tell their daughters. Secret stories. Stories that would prove a mother was once young, done things with men she could never tell, in ways she could never tell, in places she could never. Private stories where love, any semblance of love, would lead a person like me to the place I was that night in 1848 when I died. For 2 days and two nights we've been running. Me and the child inside me. Pain is trying to get me to stop, make me push away the pain, but I won't push. My pretty yellow dress is stained red and brown now, but not by the blood of the man I killed like they think. It's mine. The dark of night's been hiding my running for a while, muffling the sounds of my chest, gushing in and out from my own hard breaths. Every few steps, the blue light of the moon sneaks past the treetops and strokes my face, urging me on. The only mercy I get in these hot Alabama woods. The devil's coming and I have to keep moving for this baby, for me. But the pain's burning so bad now I can't hardly do nothing but fall against this old tree, hands slip sliding down its trunk, stinging. Barking from the hunting dogs is shooting across the air and bumping around inside me. I have to move faster, run like sister once told me to. I beg my belly, hold on to me, it ain't time. But this baby's got a plan. Her head's at my opening spot, burning hot, ripping my hips wide apart, carving a way out. I hold in my screams and bow over hard in the dirt, knees first. A man's voice shouts, "This way, she's up this way. I want to live, want this baby to live, but she's betraying me. Every muscle in my body slamming shut, so I push. She's tearing through me, I push. I don't want to, but I push. Screaming mute deep inside myself, pushing so hard but hollering so low so they can't hear me. A wave of warm water pours out of me, carrying my joy and deep sorrow. Before God and this oak tree she come, and she don't cry. I guess she want us to live too. I move her into the triangle of moonlight that sets my arm aglow, and she see me, and I see in her the good part of love. The weight of them push me over, these dogs clawing and biting at my back, but the pain ain't gonna make me give her up to them. I gotta protect her, get up, keep running. I feel my legs, so I bend them. I feel them firm on the ground, so I push up. I hold her close with one arm and pull up with the other. I can make it. I tell myself again how to run, counting my steps. One, two, one, two, one, two. A spark of light. A loud pop. Nothing. My last thought is to not fall on my baby. Thank you. Thank you so much. So that's the opening of the novel. It was the first thing I saw when I got the inspiration for this book. At the time, my son, I have a 9 and a 10-year-old, but at the time, my son was sick, and he had just been born, and the doctors were telling me that there was nothing wrong with him, but I knew that there was something that was not right. My daughter had just been born the year before, and he was behaving differently, and I thought he was going to die, and so I was going to my doctor saying, you know, something's wrong with my son, something's wrong with my son, and after a while, the issue was, maybe there's something wrong with you, and he wasn't diagnosed then, but he had a genetic condition that caused certain chemicals to be withheld in his brain and caused muscle weakness. So he doesn't speak now. He knows about 12 words. He walked when he was just over 3. He learned to run when he was 6. But at that time, I didn't know what was wrong with him, and the doctors didn't know what was wrong with him. So I would never put him down because I thought he was going to die. Because when I would read stories about families who lost their children, the story was always the same. The narrative was, we put her down for a nap, we came back, and she was gone. So I thought, I'm not going to put him down, I'll just always hold him. And I would ask my husband to do the same thing and just say, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm not crazy. You just have to trust me, something's wrong. And I was walking down the hallway, and I had a vision, I don't know, a dream, a daydream, I don't know what you call it, but I was holding him, and it was nighttime. I was in the woods. I knew it was Alabama, and I remember the moon, and there was a girl running by me, and I knew she was a slave, and it was like I could hear her, and she was pregnant. She had on a yellow dress and had blood on it, and then after I saw that, I mean, it must have only took a second. You know, the way we dream, you know, you dream in a second, but it feels like you've been there forever. And I gave my son to my husband, who was sitting on the sofa, and I said, can you just hold him? I need to write down what I saw. And I sort of held this thing, not knowing what to do with it, but I knew it was something. And I don't know where stories come from or dreams, you know. For me, it's God, some part of it, but I wanted to tell the story, and I didn't know what it meant till, you know, a couple years later when a friend died and I knew what the rest of the story was about. But I'd always been a writer, and that was just one of those times where I felt like something special happened. So this book is about outcast women on the eve of the Civil War. And I also describe it as a book about how to live even when you live in fear. So not all of my characters are in slavery. In fact, my main character is only a slave for a short time. She becomes a runaway, and she encounters different women along the path. She goes and she's part of a brothel. She, you know, there's women who are divorced. And it talks a lot about what it means to be a woman and how do we survive at a time when, you know, your survival was based on marriage or your own family because you couldn't work, you know, things like that. So all of this is incorporated in this story. And one of the most, the biggest moments for this character, or one of her biggest relationships for the main character, is her relationship with her sister. So I'm going to read just a portion of that. Fonsdale, Alabama, 1838. The knocking's always there behind the wall in Mama's room. I call it Mama's music. My sister Hazel calls it Mama's tired tune, a shrill note sucked and blown from a stiff reed. Hazel's the closest thing I got to a good daddy, so she never beat me for misbehaving. She never leaves me long, and she never tries to touch me the wrong way. She keeps me safe in this world, keeps me safe from the knocking. We sit in the back of our dark two-room shack, huddled under a blanket together. She's trying to drown out Mama's song with her hand cupped over my ear, fogging it up with her whispering, telling me we're gonna play a game called Let's See Who Could Fall Asleep the Fastest. But after 10 minutes of trying, even the late of midnight can't shake my eyelids free. So now me and Hazel gonna play a new game. It's called Who Could Be the Quietest the Longest. But we always quiet, though. We gotta be so Massa don't remember we here. Hazel say Massa might forget about her the way he did me, since I was born early and he ain't sure I come at all. The whiskey keeps him guessing and asking every year. He comes out to the yard in the fall time to hand out our yearly portions, and he mumbles his question about me under his breath into the air like he ain't really asking. Hazel says he scratch his head and squint his eyes, rub his belly, and mumble some words about a baby from a while back. Too unsure to make his words clear, but hoping somebody pick up on him anyway and cure his memory and tell on me. But nobody do. My mama's worth protecting, so everybody look at him wall-eyed till he leave his question alone. Me and Hazel go out late at night or at dusk when Massa's gone to town or ain't coming back for days. We was wrong twice. Had to run back fast. The fear made me faster than Hazel, faster than Massa, too. It was dusk both times. See, dusk is where it's safe, and dusk is where the magic is. It's where you can hide things in the orange-pink shade of a losing day. Even the green waters of Moss Lake get blended gone from dusk. You can stand a running leap away from its waves and not see the water like it's just another part of the field. Dusk blends me away, too. It's why Hazel takes me out in it, hand-holding, running me through the short patch of the woods to the flatlands where gray shadows form 4 feet above the ground, mouth height, and buzz. Netted clouds of gnats they are, and we race the light through them, and they spread when we do. Then they close behind us, recaptured. I spit out the slow ones. Hazel say I get my speed from my daddy, and I hate that we ain't got the same one, though. Her daddy was the nigga before boss, and mine was a tenant farmer that Massa tried to sell a bad piece of land to. Before you know it, Massa would have told him, you'll have your own slaves, too. The same way he promised every poor white fool written land from him. Probably made the offer on one of his celebration nights when he would spend the money he didn't have and invite the whole town and make Mama dress up and smile. I tell peoples my daddy was an Indian like the ones I seen around here. Hazel keep my hair braided long down my back to prove it. We lie 'cause family's more important than truth, and ain't no point in reminding Mama. So that's about her relationship with her sister, which is pivotal in her life. And she keeps going back to these moments. The story is structured in a way where she's having these flashbacks. She's passed on. And often people ask me about where the structure came from. And there was a time where I would hear, I like to listen to stories when people because I used to care for my mom and my grandmother when they were sick, and my grandmother before she died. And sometimes people would talk about dying often, and about these flashes they get. They say your life flashes before you, when you have like this moment where you're about to die or something like that. And then I was curious about what moments people got to see of their lives. Like, who chooses that? Do we have some place in our brain that stores up? You get to see your wedding day. You get to see your the first time you held your child or whatever. So the story is sort of structured, or part of the story is structured in flashbacks. So this is one of the characters she encounters is someone named Cynthia. And she's a prostitute, and she has a 10-year-old son who lives with her in the brothel, and his name is Johnny. I saw him attack a grown man once. I came in from fetching eggs, started my day in darkness, and found him waiting like a cowboy at high noon. He had readied himself for the man to come out of his mama's bedroom, and I hid myself behind Bernadette's door. From there, I watched the boy watch the man through the crack of his mama's door. Her noise-making wasn't motherly. But when man finished his pleasure inside Cynthia, man held her the way she holds Johnny at night. So when man walked out, Johnny beat him around the waist with both fists and caught one in man's crotch. Man twisted Johnny's arms behind him, told Cynthia, "Control your son," said, "Have a nice day." Happened so fast, Cynthia didn't do nothing. Johnny lets men walk by now. He watches them go in her door one way, buckling their belts on the way out. They step over him in the doorway like he ain't a boy wanting his mama. We all hear her good reasons through our thin walls and empty hallways. She yells she got bills to pay, his mouth to feed, clothes and shelter Johnny needs. We only grumble. Go back to our own hard days and hard nights. I tend to my swollen and parched brown ankles, be on my feet all day. I gotta shut up the voices in my head telling me to leave this place. But Johnny, he's tracking years, thinking of the future, wanting his mama's touches, remembering the past as if it's time already gone. So sometimes he'll hang on her arm when a customer comes, wanting her to touch him, even if it's to push him away. And sometimes he'll kick and scream till she picks him up like an accident hug before she sets him at the end of the hallway. And sometimes when she's in the middle of doing her business, he'll walk in on her, stand next to her, asking for water. So that's Johnny. That's the son of one of the main characters. And then I'll leave you with Cynthia. I must have been sleeping good because she changed my clothes and gave me a new pillow stuffed with mint. The boy Johnny's gone, and a man's there in the boy's place, sitting on the corner of the bed with his back turned to me. His red neck looks like not done meat with white lines creased deep and jagged across it. His grayish hair is lined with a razor's edge above his neck. I see him in the mirror smiling, and when he laughs, his shoulders bounce. When he ain't laughing, his teeth poke out his mouth like an egg halfway out of chicken. He covers his mouth with one hand to hide it and let his buck teeth wet his palm. When he pulls his hand away, he stretches his lips to cover over him. The woman slouches in her chair, painting her makeup on. Her silk gown clings to her curves. The man was fixing to say something but took a deep breath instead. Finally, he gets up and goes to her, puts his hand on her shoulder, squeezes. "Cynthia," he say, "I want to take you away from here, give you the good life." Cynthia laughs out loud. "And make a good woman out of me, Nate?" She throws her wash rag in the basin. "Take me away from my kingdom." She squats above her chair, smacks the wet rag between her legs and swishes it around her privates, then stands up and sprays a burst of perfume there too. She slides her frilly breeches over her hips. He puts his hands back on her shoulders. "Come on, Nate, I got a headache and another customer. Just pay me and go." "I'm serious," he say. She clears the snot from her throat, hocks it in a rag and throws it back in the basin, then falls back in her chair and takes a fancy silver box off the table. She pulls out a cigarette. "You still here?" He grabs his hat and coat from off the dresser. Hiding under him is a bunch of yellow flowers. She smiles. "You getting soft on me, Nate?" "I know you like yellow," he say. "I could bring you flowers every day if you let me. Be the man you want me to be." He crouches on one knee, holds the flowers out to her. She lets him rub her thigh and he say, "I love you. You know that. I could look after you. You could stop what you're doing here and just be mine. Her expression softens. Hell, you say, I'd even look after your bastard. Every boy needs a daddy. She stiffens, lights her cigarette, sucks it started, and blows the smoke over his flowers and say, I'm allergic to little dicks and spare change. So like I said nice before, get the fuck out. So that's Cynthia. She's that kind of character throughout the book. I'm an attorney, so I do I work with nonprofits, and I do what they call post-conviction work. So I work with people who want a second chance at life. So that they're able to move on with their life without the stigma of their past. Things that they've done at 19, 20 years old, and now they're 50, 60 years old, just wanting to move on with their life. That's where I help to erase their records or give them a second chance. To vote, you know, especially now, and get some of their rights back, especially the felons, or to get their children out of foster care, or their grandchildren usually. I once had a dad who just wanted to drive the bus at the college, and he couldn't because he had a felony where he had been beaten up and he got in a fight, a Vietnamese client. He wanted to drive the bus and watch his daughter go to school at UCLA, and he couldn't do it, and he had worked so hard and saved all his tips, so it was a big moment. Or the grandmother who had spent most of her 20s and 30s in prison, and she worked in the cafeteria at the children's hospital, and she wanted to get her granddaughter out of foster care. I've also had a client where, you know, he was married, he was 80 years old, and when he was younger, he was also married. He had an encounter, a consensual encounter with a man in a bathroom, and was arrested and was a felon because of the way the laws were in the 1950s. And when he came to me, he says, I don't want to die a felon. And so we were able to rewrite his story. So I spend a lot of time with narratives and the stories of people's lives, retelling them in a way, or retelling what they've done since their conviction so that they can move on with their life. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about justice and what it means to be what justice is. And grace is part of that, you know. There's grace, there's mercy, and there's justice. So justice for me, one definition, is getting back the thing that you lost. So if I steal $100 from you, I get my $100 back plus, you know, whatever it costs me to get that, my court fees and all that. Mercy is not getting the bad thing that you deserve, somebody withholding that. Grace is getting a good thing even though you don't deserve it. And so I think a lot about that in writing this book. And there's a section here where I write about what the definition of justice is. There's no such thing as justice when somebody's killed, only satisfaction. The person can't be brought back for no amount of punishment or cost. I can't have the old Josie back and I've been long gone. My loss is worse when I think about how George got away with it and how he did it. How he had to have been watching Josie before it happened. Watching her the way animals do prey. How else would he have known that Charles would have been gone that day or the moment she'd come home? George was there waiting in the dark for her, black. Blending into trees, black. Squatting behind a bush, black. Pushing the leaves aside to make space for his peeping eye, black. There's no justice for that. And finally, really this time, finally. Because I forgot I had 20 minutes. So a lot of the things that I see about the injustices in the world today are the things that we see on the surface. You know, like especially the, you know, all the killings that are happening, which break my heart. I think about, you know, something that's always existed in our country, probably in civilization, but there's a lot of issues too, like immigration. You know, these are questions that we're asking ourselves. Again, I was on the plane with someone who was talking about how his parents were illegal. They were Polish, and they were here illegally for a long time, and he didn't realize his parents were illegal aliens when they came here and gave birth to him, and he was born in this country. And we were kind of talking about that, so I told him I would read this section. It's about what it means to be American. The American Civil War started a year ago April, and I don't know what it means to be American. I'm not. The war began when a Frenchman, Pierre Beauregard, a one-star general, ordered his troops to open fire on Americans with 50 cannons at Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina. Even though folks in town proudly call Pierre Little Napoleon, nobody calls him French but me, because I'm fair. They don't call him French here because he's white and rich and born here, mostly. His family was of a French colony in Louisiana, and that French family line led him there from France. He didn't speak English till he was 12 years old. So I don't know how many generations on American soil you gotta live before you're called American, or if English has to be your first language. No matter what, Negroes may always be foreigners, but I'm here. So that's it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I just delightful. But I wanted to ask you, to my ear, your prose sounds like poetry.
Oh,
are you also a poet?
No, I'm not a poet. It's okay. You know, it's how I hear language, you know, the musicality of language. I hear it like a song, all of it. And I just feel like I'm just playing a song. I don't know. Thank you so much. Thank you. Hi.
I loved the reading. It was really wonderful.
Thank you.
I think you really should do the audiobook.
Oh, thank you.
Because your reading is so moving
It
would be wonderful for you to do the audiobook of this.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. I wish I could have. They recorded it like right after, before it came out. It was recorded by an actress, Lisa Renee Pitts, who played Dr. Dre's mom in the movie Straight Outta Compton. She recorded it, and I didn't know that it was already done until she tweeted about it. And I was like, oh, it's gone, it's over. But I'm sure she did a great job. I just got a copy, but I can't listen to it yet.
I know you said that grace is getting something good you don't deserve. And I think in the book, Naomi says she would have named Josephine Grace if she had the chance. Yeah. Just wondering why would she do that?
There's a lot of, for the main character, there's a lot of issues of self-worth, like what she feels that she's worth. There's a lot of shame in it. And when her daughter was born, she felt that she got something that she didn't deserve, this great, beautiful thing that she didn't deserve in her own life. There's a section in this book that I can't read, so I'm happy that I didn't do the audiobook because there's a lot of shame in it. And I can't even read it. I can't read it aloud, but I definitely can't even read it when I look in the book, because I think for a lot of women, maybe, and I've worked with a lot of women, you know, dealt with abuse and things like that, because I help victims as well as represent the perpetrators. But there's moments that we have where there's a lot of shame, where you think, if I just didn't do this thing, or if I just didn't go here, if anybody finds out that I did this, you know, if they knew. And she has this moment where I wanted to put her through that, because it represents to me every woman's moment of shame, you know, whether it's walk of shame or whatever. But there's something even more than that, and I wanted to hold readers there. And it's something that I can't do when I read it, because I've had my own moment where I'm like, I can never tell anybody that that happened, or I'm so ashamed of that thing. And all those things that we are allowed to move on from. So when her daughter is born, it represents everything that she thought she didn't deserve. And there's a line in the book where she says, I don't think that I'll live, because her mother dies her mom is 35 when she dies. So she says, I don't think that I'll live beyond 35 years old because I don't deserve more than what my mom had. And so that's the lot. So there's a lot of shame in what we deserve and self-worth, which is something, and I'm sure men go through the same thing too, but I definitely want it to be something that this character feels. So when her daughter is born, she would have named her Grace, but she never gets a chance to.
I have a two-part question. First, you spoke about the vision that came to you initially when you were carrying your son and then you just went to write it down. When did that take you into the book and in terms of actually crafting the story? And then the other question is, how long did it take you to write this?
Okay, that's a good question. So from the time that I got the story till the time I finished it was 7 years. But when that moment came, my son, I had two children under 2 years old. My daughter was just, you know, 1.5. So I wasn't really writing earnestly. I would write at traffic stops. I would write, you know, at lunchtime. But it took about 3 years from the time when I said, okay, I'm going to write this. I'm going to finish this story. Because I felt like it was given to me as a gift, and I needed to finish it, like carry it past the finish line. So whatever happened, and it's just amazed me. You know, even being here, I was telling Andy, you know, we ate before. Just being here is I look around and it's just amazing. I'm just in wonder. You know, I feel like all I had to do was just get it, just finish it. And then, you know, the New York Times and people are responding to it, and it's just overwhelming, and it's a beautiful thing. I'll start crying if I keep going, so I'll shut up.
About your research process. And where are you from originally?
So my family is from a small town in Alabama. And during the migration, the Great Migration for African Americans in the 70s, they moved to Los Angeles. So I was born in Los Angeles, but all my family is from Tallahassee, Alabama, which is one of the settings of this novel. And I used to ask them questions like, you know, why didn't you ever leave? You know, why are you the first people since the end of American slavery to leave the town where you were captive and everything? You know, so it was a question that was always on my mind, like, why didn't people leave? And as I was doing research for this book, you know, I was able to connect the dots. You know, the Civil War started. 2 years into the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. You know, President Lincoln, his signature ended slavery in the middle of the Civil War. 3 million people were set free. The actual Civil War didn't end for another 2 years. So people had nowhere to go. Not only did they have no food, no money, no place to go, they would have to literally walk across battlefields. And I don't think that fear ever left a lot of people. And I think those ghosts are still here, everything that happened from there. But as far as research, I would find myself in research holes. I would just go down the rabbit hole. I'd be like, oh, I got to find out about absinthe. You know, how do you do that? You know, and I could spend 2 days on anything, you know, especially the Underground Railroad. It was shocking to me when I found out, you know, I had a traditional public school education, but finding out that the Underground Railroad didn't even go to Alabama and Georgia. It only went as far south as Virginia. So I was wondering, how did people get out? You know, and we tell this narrative like there was hope for everyone, all you had to do. And, you know, Philadelphia has such a history, you know, here with the Underground Railroad. But yeah, people didn't have hope. They were hopeless for so long. So I would find things out. So it became a process of telling the story first that I felt like I was given, and then finding things out and changing it as I needed to. So, for instance, my characters try to go south into Mexico rather than north. You know, it was just as much an option. So research to find things out, you know, finding out, oh, you can't say okay. You know, they wouldn't have said okay, or they didn't have bananas, you know, in the south at that time. You know, little things that could just... And then I'm researching bananas. Like, when did bananas come to the South? You know, and it could just be this terrible trap. But, you know, trying to make it as accurate as possible. And, you know, the Pierre Beauregard, finding out that he was French, you know. And when we talk about the American Civil War and fighting for states' rights, there's a certain kind of American who embraces the Confederacy, you know, part of Civil War, not realizing
that it was actually an immigrant who didn't even speak English till he was 12 years old. Everything that you say that you dislike is actually the thing that you're embracing right now was, it was a Frenchman, and a lot of people called him French. So things like that, that just struck me, that I thought was interesting, I tried to include in the book. Even though it's a fictional account, I tried to make it as accurate as possible. You're welcome. Thank you.
What was your initial purpose for writing the book? And as you were writing it, did it change?
The initial reason why I wrote it was I had this vision of the opening of this book, which is largely unchanged from when I wrote it. You know, there's a few words changed, but it's pretty much the same opening. But I wanted to tell a story of history in a way that made more sense. There were holes to me that I didn't understand. There's a narrative of history. It didn't make sense to me since the beginning of America. We've only not been in armed conflict for just over 20 years of that time. So we're going from one war, like after the Civil War, there's the Indian War. Then we're just constantly in wars, you know, and then there's in the middle of that, there's the gold rush, you know, all this history compressed in a very short span of time. So I wanted to look at who we are as Americans. And when I lived in England, it was the first time someone called me an American. I was 28 years old, 29. And I remember being struck by, they said, oh, the American. And I'm looking around like, who are they talking about? Who's American? Because I never, even though I am American and I know that, but the way that we sometimes talk about the people who say, you know, to sing the songs about being American, they don't look like me. And it's something that I know that I am. But so things like that would just strike me as, why do I think that way? Why can't I be in my Daisy Dukes with American flag tank top? I don't know. Why wouldn't I do that? I mean, there's reasons I wouldn't do that anyway. But but that's not how I identify. So little things like that. So I wanted to look back on my own life, my family's history of being in the South. Like, most of them are still there. The church that my great-great-grandparents started in that little town is still there. And they called themselves Africans, African Methodist Episcopal Church, you know, all that. So I wanted to know, who am I? Who are we? And then I was seeing a lot of parallels with then and now. We're still in these different slaveries. Americans, that was a system. Slavery is a system that devalued human beings. And that's why you have Black Lives Matter saying we're in a system that devalues Black lives. Why do we even have to say that unless we're still here, unless there's still these thoughts that you're less valuable? At the recent the convention a few days ago, someone said that, you know, this is a subgroup, you know, the non-white subgroups. You know, there was a lot of talk about the speech and who's copying that. I said, why would they call non-white people subgroups? Things like that. So where do we get this from? Who are we? And what are these systems? Sometimes we see the result of the system, you know, the pimples, but we don't see the systems that cause us to be who we are. I work in a lot of prisons, so these issues are really close to my heart. So I go and talk to prisoners about hope. You know, what kind of hope do you have when you're a prisoner for the rest of your life, or 25 years, or 10 years, or 12 years, and finding hope? And prisons are where we are warehousing people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and we see the results. So people don't really see the results of the systems that we're a part of every day. So, like death is the same kind of way. We don't see those things. So I wanted to explore all of that. Sorry, that was a long, complicated, dark answer, but yes, it's the truth for me. I wanted to tell the whole truth.
Thank you. Okay. I was struck throughout the book by the notion of grace, and it wasn't until having a conversation before we came here that I was brought back to the original definition that you give in the book of grace versus justice versus mercy. And the phrase that really struck me in the book, or has stayed with me, is when Bessie says, there's no justice, only grace. It's Bessie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And But yet at the end, it feels like what is achieved is just a little bit of justice. So I guess I would love to hear a little bit more about that idea of grace, and whether that was part of what you were putting together when you were putting together the story of all of these women, and whether it really is just... Where that definition that you read at the beginning came from for you, of something that you don't deserve but achieve.
When I think about the conflicts that are going on in the world, I think about, you know, how does it stop? You know, when you have police officers being killed, when you have black men being killed, or other in other groups, other people being killed. How do we stop this? What does that truce look like? And there's a poem that I love, and I can't remember the poet's name, but there's a moment he says, what if we just stop flailing our arms so much? What if we just sit here quietly? What if we do that? What if we give each other grace? Yeah, you did this to me, but maybe we could just stop it right here. Maybe we can move on and do something better. So that's grace. But justice is punishing. Punishment is part of that. So when you punish someone, like when they die, whether it's death penalty or whatever, there's a punishment. Somebody has to pay for that thing. And as long as we continue to think that somebody has to pay for every loss that we suffer, I don't think that we can get moved beyond where we are right now. We have to be able, as Americans, in my opinion, to hold, and I was telling Andy this but when we were coming in, I think we have to be able to stand against injustice. That has to be our full stop. We don't tolerate injustice, but we also have to be able to hold two thoughts in our minds at the same time. Maybe the, in this case of the police, maybe the police officer was scared. Maybe this man really was innocent. And we all have to be able to do that. But right now, the way that our systems are, we run to a side, no matter what it is. We run to a side. And I'm not saying, and it's so complicated, but really we just have to stop moving our arms around so much. If our only goal is to prevent injustices happening to anyone, we have to make that the priority and then be able to say, maybe these people are right. Maybe these people, maybe there's something to it. And I don't think we're there yet, but that's grace. That's, and it's sitting there and listening and accepting that police officers have a hard job. They live in fear. There's systematic racism that devalues black bodies and black lives. Maybe that's true. And maybe there's proof. And maybe they're just not protesting for no reason. And so that's why I talk a lot about grace. In the end of the book, you know, because things don't always end in grace. Usually they don't end in grace. They end in somebody wanting justice. No justice, no peace.
I have two questions, actually, and the first one is about Cynthia and her death, and I'm curious if there was a larger reason or significance to the way you wrote her death or the way that she died in light of the theme of grace and justice and mercy. Mm-hmm. So that's my first question. And my second question is somewhat unrelated. So maybe I'll let you answer that one.
I just knew that she had to... Cynthia was based on a real person that I knew growing up. She terrified me. I grew up very conservative Christian. And when my parents split up, my mom was pretty much on her own. And the church that we went to didn't talk to her. She was an outcast, much like one of the characters is in this book, Annie, who is a white woman who owns a business. And I remember at that time, because I was young, I was, 15 or 16, not that young, but I remember thinking that that was a weakness. I thought that she was weak because she couldn't balance a checkbook. She didn't know how to drive that well. How could you not be that way? And I thought that was a weakness, not really realizing at that time that different women have different kinds of strong. Like, she was strong enough to be there to raise us, to love us, to not abandon us, And then there was a Cynthia who we met at the park. I never actually had a conversation with her because she terrified me, but she was loud, she was crass, and she died. And she died in a way that was similar to what happened in the book. And I wanted to honor her because I looked up to her, even though I was afraid of her, because she was everything that I thought my mother wasn't. But she was strong, you know, because we're all different. So I wanted to honor her in the book. She was Jewish. She was a former prostitute. She married her John and moved around the corner. And I wanted to honor her in the book without being, you know, because sometimes we don't like to do that as women. We like to be disrespectful. If somebody's different than who we are, then it must be they're doing it wrong. But it's not true.
Thanks. Thanks for that. And then my second question, I suppose it's a question, but another piece of this book that really lingered with me as I was reading it and then even after was about the multi-generational kind of tracking of these women in the book. And you started out tonight, and it reminded me the way the book started, mentioning, you know, those secrets and that shame and kind of the generation after generation of abuse and horror and being strong and moving on, but kind of the shame of that. And then you spoke a little bit about generation after generation in this book, especially the concept of deserving or deserving more. And that's something that I think is often unspoken as we think about how far we've come in any kind of social issue, and as many things are playing out. So I just, that was something that really struck me, and I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about what you were trying to share through this book when it comes to that cycle.
I think all of us are caught in a cycle of our family. You know, we do the things that we've always done one way or the other, our personality, the things we care about. Even as a country, we're caught in these cycles, you know, of it's the same cycle, different players, same cycle, different players every time. And the way that we approach problems, it's the same way, because laws are made by whoever is in power at the time, you know, whether we like it or not. Everything that, you know, the former presidencies, beyond even the current one, you know, they make rules, and then whoever's in power now will change those and so on. So we have these cycles. At some point, we have to break the cycles that hurt us, and we haven't been able to break cycles like racism and other isms. And I think in order to do that, we have to see ourselves first as a family, or find new families that can support, you know, our new communities within ourselves that support those good things, whatever they are. So I wanted to show the cyclical nature, especially of abuse, that continues. It just perpetuates itself. All kinds of abuses, and that's in the book. And it passes down mother to daughter, father to son, nation, and even within our nation. So I was really concerned about breaking cycles in the book, and how do you do that, you know, when you've done it the same way? And a lot of people be, you know, if they live on the East Coast, I'm moving to LA, you know, I'm getting away from my mom or my grandma or my dad or whatever. So there's things that we do in our own personal lives where we break cycles. If I could just get away and focus on yoga or whatever, I mean, that's what we have a lot of in LA, you know, or vice versa, you know, people. So how do we break? We have to get away from certain things. There are some toxic relationships. You have to love people at a distance. Be like, I love you, okay. You know, but we have to, there are some serious cycles that America is confronting right now, especially with election season, and just all of our ugliness is coming out. We have to learn how to break some cycles. But there's hope in that. And that's the one thing I really wanted to bring across in this book, is that there's hope. A lot of people tell me, you know, there's no hope. Nothing's going to change. It's always been like that. And I recently had someone who was upset with me about an essay that I wrote, you know, and he just said, you know, there's all these people in prisons who have no hope. They're brilliant minds in prisons that have no hope. And I told him, I said, the moment you have no hope, you lose. In this game of life, the person who has no hope, even a brilliant mind, will lose. There's nothing you can change without hope. You have to have vision. So, like in my faith, they say, where you have no vision, the people perish. We have to have vision. We have to be able to see something that doesn't exist and go after it and form relationships and communities that can support that vision, whatever that thing is, and try not to hurt people. And we don't do that. So in the prison where I teach, there's 170 dorms, Most of them are segregated by race. So if you're white, you're in this one. If you're black, you're in this one. Latino, gay, is very segregated in the prison system, at least in California. And there are, of those 170, there are four what they call no politics dorms. So those prisoners are like, you know, there's no hope here. It's so racist. We're so segregated. There's no hope. And I'm like, you have four. Your job is to hold on to that four. There's hope in that. And if you could get five, you got five. If you focus on the 100 and, you know, and 65, 66 that are problematic, you're not going to be able to hold on to what you have without hope, because it doesn't matter. And it just comes in. So it's really about holding on to that and having hope in no matter what circumstance you're in. And we're all alive, so we have a day to change it as long as we're breathing. So.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I want to say first, I like your look. I'm a high school teacher.
Oh, right.
And I think that my students would be able to relate with you. You know, being an intellectual, but you don't look like the typical intellectual.
Thank you. You know, is that a compliment?
I don't want to say it. Most intellectuals wouldn't like it, but yeah, it was a compliment.
Right.
But so that I like that my students, they could probably see you and relate. You know, I enjoyed your reading.
Thank you.
And I liked your definition of justice. I think you said getting back something that was yours or something that belongs to you.
That you don't deserve, getting a good thing that you don't
deserve. No, justice.
Oh, justice is getting back what you deserve, yeah.
Right, something of yours. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of a definition of justice that I heard, which is from the Arabic word adl. It means putting things in their rightful place.
Right.
So I think there's a connection there.
Yeah.
And as you were talking, and the lady asked you about justice and different things, I was just thinking, with the roots and foundation of this of our nation, and you're saying the conflicts and issues we have now, doesn't that arise from the roots of our nation? And what do you say about putting things in their rightful place and giving people back what is theirs in order to have justice in our nation?
Mm-hmm. I look at the foundations of our nation, and, you know, like, if anybody's honest about our history, we have a brutal history where we've dehumanized, there's a lot of injustices that America represents. And that's why when I talk about things like justice, is justice what we really, is that going to solve the problem, justice? Or is it mercy or is it grace? I see them as three different things. If we want justice, it's gonna be exactly what we have right now. It's going to be back and forth. I don't think that it'll ever end. So when I say that justice is, like your definition, I love that, putting everything back in its rightful place. But sometimes, what are you going to do that? You know, that becomes the question. How do you do that? Then you're talking about reparations and worse. I don't believe that there's, one of the pieces that I don't believe that there's justice when someone dies. You can only punish someone, or you could choose grace, which is to move on. I don't know that justice is the right, I think we have to change the questions that we ask. We have to change, like, we're hearing the same questions that we've been asking the same questions since the 60s, even before then, you know, back in slavery, they're saying, when are we going to get justice? But maybe there's something else, maybe there's something better, and maybe it's going to have to start with a new understanding. Because justice is going to get there, if you work backwards from that, I think everybody, if they were honest with themselves, would know what that would require. And it's not a pretty world. It's not a good America. And I'm not saying it has to be pretty. I'm just saying that I have children here. Other people have children here. We have to survive, and we have to learn how to move forward. And I don't think we're asking the right questions that are going to get us there, or wanting justice is necessarily going to get us there. I think there's something else. I don't have answers. I'm just saying, let's look at a different picture. But if we're only going toward justice, justice means something else. So I don't think justice necessarily is the answer. I don't know if that makes sense.
So you deliver a lot of truths, which are hard truths. And I wanted to know if you had trouble or backlash trying to publish this or before or after? And if you want to share some of that with us.
Yeah, so I've had a lot of backlash. Well, I mean, it was difficult to publish. So, I mean, a lot of publishers, you know, but that happens to a lot of writers where your manuscript is rejected. But the things that they wanted to change were things that I couldn't negotiate on, like the Emancipation Proclamation. A lot of people were saying, that's a happy day for slaves, you know. Or, you know, too much violence was another thing. Because I try to tell the whole, like I said, I try to tell the whole truth in it. I don't want to shy away from it. The use of the N-word, you know. So I just had an interview yesterday where someone had a real big problem with the use of the N-word. And I said, I wanted to tell the whole truth about what it means to me. We throw around the word, the N-word, for instance, even in my own culture. But what does that mean, really? So I want to slow it down, especially in the beginning. What does it mean when a mother who's about to give birth to a baby calls herself this word? Doesn't that bother you? So I want to ask people, does that bother you that we offend each other this way? Does that hurt? It hurts me. So a lot of the book is, you know, and we talk about rape, you know, it's like every African American in this country is 16% white. That was a study that just came out. And like, how did that happen? You know, and we tell these love stories about Thomas Jefferson and his, you know. So I said, let's look at it. Let's look at the things that we think we believe, because sometimes it's easier to romanticize the past than deal with it head on. And I think we have to deal with these things head on in order to move forward. We have to be honest with ourselves as a country, and that's all of us. Not to punish us, but to be better, so.
My other question is, you said, I'm a writer. I have been a writer. And this is your first novel. So what else did you write?
So I have a lot of essays and short stories, but I didn't take myself seriously as a writer because I did it for work, you know, telling other people's stories as an attorney. But I've always told stories. I've always written stories. I have 6 brothers and sisters. So I was the family story. I love to tell stories and to find things out. So it's just a continuation of the same thing. But this is the first novel that I finished, right? And I'm working on a new one, so we'll see. Thank you so much. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.